Today on Ag News Daily.
I think what's really interesting about this 2,4-D population is it truly demonstrates the importance of our herbicide use patterns on the development of resistance, because this was not a population that was in a crop field. It was a population in a road ditch.
Welcome back to the Tuesday edition of the Ag News Daily podcast, March 5th, 2024. Tanner and Delaney hanging out together virtually today to bring you the latest headlines. You got some good news today, Delaney?
I feel like news is fairly slow today, Tanner.
Yeah, it's always that. I wish I could go back to that episode where I gave Tuesday a really good nickname. It's not Turnaround Tuesday. It's not the Terrible Tuesday, but it just seems like news is slow on Tuesdays.
Well, maybe it is. Maybe there's some sort of conspiracy theory behind that.
Very well, it could be. I know some of our listeners up in North Dakota are going to not like this news coming their way. They've got heavy snow in the forecast on top of what is already hitting their region. They could expect several inches today and into this afternoon and the evening. 4 to 6 inches of snow is projected in the area, according to the Northwest or the National Weather Service. Another 2 inches is possible Wednesday and Thursday. So we could see in some spots, Delaney, nearly a foot of snow before the weekend. Falling snow will cause slick roads and reduce visibility down to less than two miles. Then we head down to the southeastern region. Thunderstorms are possible for southeastern Oklahoma this afternoon that may return tomorrow and continue through Friday as well. Thursday afternoon into evening, those storms over the southern parts of Oklahoma could come with hail and damaging winds. And not sure if I hit on it yesterday as far as weather goes, but California got hit with significant amount of snow in portions of their state, up to 10 feet in some areas, accompanied by winds of up to over 100 miles per hour. Parts of Interstate 80 were completely shut down and drivers stranded as they were very quickly drifted over and some drivers drifted in. So quite a wild little bit of news there for weather, Delaney.
It certainly is. And as we look at states with the worst drought heading into planting season, Iowa pretty well takes the cake, except for New Mexico. Most other states have seen alleviated drought conditions. But as you look at Iowa, nearly 19% of the state is in D3 extreme drought, unchanged from the week prior. More than 37% of the state reported D2 or severe drought conditions, and another 23% of the state is in moderate or D1 drought conditions. Texas is somewhat dry when you look at the western part of the state. Just 2% of Texas is in extreme drought, however. And Minnesota also faces a pretty good amount of drought, but none of the state is in the D3 drought, except for the very bottom southeast corner, butting up next to Iowa. So multiple states are certainly having some drought conditions. Wisconsin is mostly the state is in a drought of some kind, but none in the severe D3 drought category, where we see that in kind of the northeast quadrant here of the state of Iowa. So heading into planting season, we'll be watching the U.S. drought monitor, Tanner, to see if any of these states get some snowfall or rainfall to help alleviate drought conditions.
Yeah, that certainly is going to start sending a signal to the markets. We talked a little bit with Ted yesterday about that. We also talked to him about China's purchases. China continues to ramp up their purchases of feed grain from around the globe, including the United States. On Monday, Bloomberg reported that China had purchased more than 20 cargoes of feed grain in just the last 2 weeks for nearly 1.2 million tons of grain. From corn to sorghum, and even barley, China continues to buy. The trade sources have been pricing out of the Pacific Northwest. However, no daily sales have been confirmed. China has purchased 10 cargoes from Ukraine also. No matter what the source of the surge in purchases are, it's clear that China is looking at stockpiling grain again. They're buying a little bit of corn. They are also looking at other feed grains. They are continuing to utilize Brazil. But as Arlen Suderman has commented in on this article, he said that it is good for U.S. corn based upon where it is currently priced, about 25 to 30 cents higher than that of Brazil corn. But Brazil is starting to switch towards soybeans, and their lower quality inventories is all that they have left. So that's good news for the U.S. Of course, quite an interesting connection of China buying from Ukraine, as there have been conversations between Putin and China's leaders. They are continuing to look at ways to get shipments out of the Red Sea. But speculation, Delaney, is that that connection with Putin was more for an agreement for safe shipping out of the Red Sea, more than that of an alliance between China and Russia. So quite interesting there, but nonetheless, it is good to see China back in the market making some purchases.
It certainly is, Tanner, and that should help booster markets here. But we got some unexpected rain in South America over the last few days, which could push or has pushed soybean futures lower in the overnight. Almost half of the crop in South America was in the bin as of late last week, according to Ag Rural. That's ahead of the 43% that was harvested at this same point last year. Brazil is expected by the USDA to produce a whopping 156 million metric tons of soybeans. If realized, would be down from last year's record of 162 million tons, but still a very large crop coming out of South America. Tanner, as we take a look here at some other news, JBS is being sued by the state of New York in their fight for reducing greenhouse global gas emissions. New York State Attorney General accused JBS of misleading the public about their climate goals. The lawsuit argues that JBS's climate pledges of having net zero emissions by 2040 are deceptive to the public because the company, in fact, has no viable plans to meet these goals. They said families are willing to spend their hard-earned money on products from brands that are better for the environment, and JBS USA's greenwashing exploits the pocketbooks of everyday Americans and promises of a healthy future, of a healthy planet for future generations. That did not go well for JBS stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, as they are applying for a listing that may count against them. But JBS has denied any wrongdoing and said they are still committed to their net zero emissions by 2040. If they are found guilty in court, the civil lawsuit requests that JBS pay up to $5,000 per violation in each state. So it's not going to be a huge slap on the wrist here for JBS.
Yeah, sounds like it's more of a reputation jab than it is a financial jab, as far as that is structured. New for the 2024 season, also coming out of Commodity Classic last week, Loveland Products has introduced their Awaken Flow Boost. This is a new seed lubricancy that can be applied at plant, which is a talc or graphite replacement. They also provide a micronutrient package benefit, 5% phosphate, 1% iron, 3% manganese, 2.5% molybdenum, and 10.5% zinc in this talc or graphite replacement. Loveland Products has made this seed treatment to ensure the flow on your planter works the best, but also for a formulation that will awaken your seeds once they are in the ground, hence the name. They're continuing to expand their product segment and sees extreme growth opportunities in this category. If you can provide additional value in replacing a product, it sounds like farmers will find this to be a great addition to their operation. Seed stewardship and safety is a top priority. This is a corn-based seed fluency agent that provides the performance of lubricancy as while it goes through the planter, just like traditional products. But they knew that they couldn't give up any efficiencies during the planting process. Side-by-side singulation test trials provided a 99.7% singulation rate and is compatible with any planter system. The trifecta of benefits is the seed singulation. There is lower dust and then the delivery of those micronutrients. So kind of an interesting new product there to share with our listeners, Delaney.
It certainly sounds that way. I missed them at the classic last week.
Absolutely. Well, the last updates I've got for my news is just more Israel Hamas updates coming from the Gaza region. The UN team found that there is clear and convincing information that hostages in Gaza, unfortunately, were sexually abused. They believe the sexual violence is still ongoing, and the UN will continue to monitor this. Israeli War Cabinet met with top US officials in Washington. Giving though the Israeli official said he is not representing the government, it was a positive conversation. UN agency also stated that Palestinian refugees have been accused of detaining and torturing some of their staffers, coercing them into making false confessions as well. So we'll continue to keep an eye on that. There is still a deadlock in negotiations, but we will continue to watch that. Also saw that there was potential new attack on a cargo ship in the region that could have been Houthi originated. So we'll watch that headline to see if more comes about. But that wraps up the news I've got for today.
Well, Tanner, I kind of wanted to end on a high note, a fun note. And yesterday, as I was sitting down to eat lunch, my husband turned on some ESPN program. I don't even remember what channel it was, but Jason Kelce has announced his retirement after 13 seasons with the Philadelphia Eagles. Why does this matter to agriculture? Well, apparently back in January, as he was kind of teasing that his retirement maybe was on the table, he mentioned that he's always been interested in farming. He said they have relatives in West Virginia and people in their family's past that has been farmers. And he started doing gardening at his house many years ago, but he hasn't had enough time to allocate to it. But he said cattle have always sparked his interest. So perhaps we're going to see Jason Kelce, like many other NFL folks currently, get some cattle or become a farmer, Tanner. But I thought that was a fun story to share with our listeners today.
Certainly need to reach out to see if we can get him to be a guest on the Ag News Daily podcast.
No kidding. He gave a really great retirement speech, so I think he would be a great guest to have on the podcast.
Absolutely. So, where do markets look like they're going to open this morning?
Well, it looks like markets are certainly having a little bit of a turnaround Tuesday here to the downside, as May corn is down about a penny and 3/4 cents in the overnight, should open around 4.28 on the board. May soybeans down a penny and a half at 11.53 and a half. Granted, we still have a few more minutes here before overnight's close, but May Chicago wheat down 9.5 cents at 5.54 and a half. Hard red May winter wheat down 8.25 at 5.72, and May spring wheat down 3.75 cents at 6.55 3/4. Livestock this morning will open after yesterday's losses. April live cattle at $1.8667. April feeder cattle at 255.75 and April lean hogs at 86.27 and a half. Tanner, we're talking about a lot of different weeds and some potential issues ahead here for the growing season with a good friend of the podcast, Megan Anderson.
We're excited to welcome back Megan Anderson, Extension Field Agronomist for Iowa State University, to talk a couple of maybe anticipated issues here in the upcoming growing season, get a little bit of a state of the agronomy world before we get into planting. Welcome back to the podcast, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
So, for the listeners that maybe don't know who you are or missed the last times that we've had a discussion, could you give us a little bit of what your role is with Iowa State University Extension?
Absolutely. So I am one of 11 field agronomists who work for Iowa State, and we each serve different county territories around the state. And so I'm an agronomist in central Iowa, and we act very much as a liaison between farmers and other ag stakeholders and our land grant institutions. So providing research-based information to farmers to help them make as good a decision as they can in the moment when they have issues or they need assistance. And then really being a voice for some of the issues that are happening out on the landscape and trying to figure out how we might be able to research them and learn more about them. So I do a lot of one-on-one work with farmers, a lot of trainings and field days and other meetings as a part of my job.
Megan, you're really kind of the go-to agronomist, I feel like, for the state of Iowa. And I know Tanner and I both follow you on Twitter or X, as they call it now, and certainly appreciate the insight that you share with growers in the field about what's going on. But as we look at 2023 in the rearview mirror, I know tar spot was a big issue you were focused on, but give us kind of a 10,000 foot overview to put a bow on what was 2023 as we talk about what's ahead here for 2024.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a big ask, but 2023 was again a pretty variable year across the state, but overall we remained dry. And so I think it was yet another year that we were surprised by how good a yields we can get with how little rainfall seemed to come. But it just seemed to come in a timely manner. And absolutely, if you look at kind of the late season rainfall map compared to the yield map of the state, you really can tell those areas that did end up getting those later season rains turned out with higher yields. Pest pressure remained an issue. We had corn rootworms. There were a lot of northern corn rootworm beetles out with a lot of uncertainty as to where those were coming from in the state. So understanding that we do have some extended diapause out on our landscape. And then, like you mentioned, tar spot was another big one that I think we had a lot of focus on. And there were absolutely pockets where that particular disease was, in some cases, kind of devastating to corn. But overall, I think our disease pressure was very low across the state, and that was reflected simply because we were so dry. But there are definitely things that we have pockets of the state that will be looking for things like corn rootworm and tar spot and other pressures looking into 2024 for sure.
Yeah, we just reported on an article stating that there is still very dry conditions across much of the Midwest, especially here in Iowa. So as our producers are looking at making some selections before they head to the field this spring, is there anything they can do to prepare for those threats?
You know, there's a lot of good improvements that have been done in hybrids and varieties and their ability to tolerate stressful conditions. Absolutely. There's some good information on how maybe our seeding rates can relate to different soil types and the stresses that we may undergo in those different soil types. And I think preparing really for a good crop is the way that we expect a good crop. And so one of the big things that I've been noticing when we are drier is that nutrient deficiencies show up faster in those dry soils. And certainly they show up much faster when our fertility levels are low. And so really that preparing for a high yielding crop is how we're going to set ourselves up to get one. And so even in the absence of moisture, which we can't really control, we need to be thinking about how are we going to get a good crop out of this growing season anyway?
Well, Bacon, one of the reasons we wanted to have you on the podcast is we saw a recent article where you were talking a little bit about the growing season ahead and had mentioned that Iowa might now be on the list of states where populations of water hemp are becoming resistant to 2,4-D. What indication led you to that conclusion, and what does that mean for growers as they think about weed management here in the 2024 growing season?
So we've had a couple of these reports come out where the product manufacturers have actually contacted us, and Iowa State very much appreciates that because at this moment in time, we don't have the same capacity that we had maybe 5 or 6 years ago to look for resistance in individual water hemp populations. And so this 2,4-D probable 2,4-D resistant report coming out of Corteva in late January follows up on two reports that came from Bayer regarding dicamba last September. And this is just, you know, this is the product of us using growth regulators more heavily, right? So, you know, we use glyphosate a lot to try to control water hemp, and we discovered water hemp populations that were resistant to glyphosate, and we've done it with other chemistries, and now we've moved very much onto these plant growth regulators in really both corn and soybean in some cases. And as we put further pressure on those, we're going to start seeing more of that occurring in field. I think what's really interesting about this 2,4-D population is it truly demonstrates the importance of our herbicide use patterns on the development of resistance, because this was not a population that was in a crop field. It was a population in a road ditch. And I've said it this winter. What does everybody do when we're done spraying our post herbicides in corn and soybean? Right? We are loading up ATVs. We're loading up maybe the Ranger, and we're going and we're treating those weeds in fence rows and potentially in road ditches. And we're often doing that with a growth regulator. And I think we're kind of seeing that now in these populations.
Yeah, isn't that interesting as you try to tie together where these patterns come from, especially when they're not in an actual field of ours. But as we saw a couple weeks ago, the headline come about the dicamba products, how is that going to affect some of the growers in your area, and what changes are they having to make?
I think that a lot of growers had already kind of moved on from using or relying heavily on dicamba post in soybean. In my geography, right, we'd moved on to a lot more of the Liberty-based systems and the Enlist or the 2,4-D-based systems. And so absolutely the loss of that chemistry is going to be challenging for some farmers to grow with. I think many have already adapted to that. I do have some concern for the perhaps the precedent that this may set, right? Because we know that those products that were used in soybean are the same types of herbicides, right? We're using a lot of dicamba-based herbicides now in corn as kind of our last resort, as we see more failures with our HPPD inhibitors. And so this is going to be a really interesting time where we have truly narrowed down these post-emergence water hemp control options to a very narrow spectrum, and we have very few options to be effective. So I have really been talking with farmers this winter about focusing on those pre's, making sure that our pre rates are up to snuff. Are they as good as we can get to try to control water hemp? Because if I can keep a water hemp plant from coming out of the ground and seeing that post, that's going to be the best situation for me as far as reducing the likelihood of creating a resistance issue with those post-emergence chemicals that we have so few of right now.
Well, Megan, as we take a look at wrapping up our conversation for today, if any of our listeners want to get more information from you or follow along with you on social media, what's the best place to go to find you?
Yeah, on social media, I'm a pretty solid X or Twitter user, and my handle on there is at MJAnders1. And then if they'd like more information from Iowa State University Extension Outreach, our crops team puts out articles and good information on crops.extension.iastate.edu, like education.
Fantastic, Megan. Well, thanks again for joining us today. Always appreciate your insight.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's always good to have Megan on the podcast, the local expert that can provide value to our listeners everywhere. But Delaney, I think that wraps up today. So what do you say? Should we let the listeners go?
Let's let them go.